I try not to live a paranoid life. I mean, I want to think that people are good, and so I don't look for bad things. I suppose because I wasn't looking for that, it just never occurred to me that it could happen.
Well, I just screamed, and he just told me to, kept telling me to shut up. He had a black mask, and the only thing that showed was his eyes, that he had a gun in his bag. If I didn't shut up, he would kill me.
With more stories of sexual harassment and assault coming to light, one common pattern is that many women did not stay silent when they were victimized. They spoke up, told people they trusted, they even told law enforcement, and they were not believed. A new book tells the story of exactly how one woman was silenced back in 2008 when she was raped and what it took for the truth to come out. A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America, is written by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists T. Christian Miller and Ken Armstrong.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. Today is a very special day. I am your host, Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And usually I'm joined by my two beloved co-hosts, Jim Clementi and Laura Richards, who could not be here today for this special podcast. You know, they're out and about being heroes and sheroes, solving crimes and beating up the bad guys. And Laura is doing amazing things. I know she wants to tell you about changing the laws abroad. So they couldn't be here today. But have no fear, because I am joined by my wingman, the Melbourne Aussie.
Dean Laffin from Melbourne, Australia. Pleased to be paneling here for Lisa and the rest of this chat. So looking forward to what we can come up with today.
That's right. And along with Dean and I wish you guys could all shout it out all together, but we also have some very special guests, the Real Crime Profile listeners. Woo! This is very meta because you're listening to yourselves being a host. So that's right. We're going to be talking about a book that hopefully we've all read, or at least read the article about, and Real Crime Profile listeners are going to be chiming in via audio, and they're also going to be texting me, or what do you call it, chatting. Any questions and comments, so please weigh in. We want to hear what you think. So our first book was I'll Be Gone in the Dark by the wonderful, the late, great Michelle McNamara, but this, for some reason, we picked another book about a serial rapist called A False Report, A True Story by T. Christian Miller and Ken Armstrong. So listen, even if you haven't read this book, I have posted the ProPublica article that you could read. It's an excellent, actually, Dean, you gave me that article. I didn't even know it was out there. You can read that. But even if you haven't done any of that, we're going to be talking about the case itself as it's, you know, depicted in this book. And the case is really just, I mean, you can't make this shit up, right? I mean, it's just one of these amazingly horrible things. So we're going to be talking about that. However, before we start talking about this book, I do want to warn listeners. I want to give you a trigger warning, okay? Because we're going to be talking about some very graphic sexual assaults. So if you or anyone you love has experienced this, you know, it may be quite an emotional trigger to talk about this. On the other hand, you may welcome us talking about this. It may be cathartic for you. I don't know where you're at, but please, you know, take care of yourself. If this is not the subject matter for you, then, you know, take care of yourself. But know that you are welcome here, and we want to hear from you. And but I just want to give you that warning before we jump in. Also joining us today, I say we have a special guest, Jolene Kinsale. Jolene, so Jolene, tell us about yourself a little bit.
I have been a 911 dispatcher for 25 years. I started out in private EMS and moved to law enforcement about 20 years ago. There's pretty much not much that I haven't dealt with, or calls I haven't taken, or calls I haven't helped out on, or investigations. So I'm pretty much well-versed in just about every aspect of it.
Okay, here we go. So first, I just want to nutshell the book summary, and then I'm going to ask you guys a bunch of questions. So in a nutshell, this book could be about, it could have started a million different ways because there's so many different points of view in this book, but it starts with a young girl named Marie, who's 18 years old, recently on her own living in Lynnwood, Washington, which if you're not from the US, that's in the Pacific Northwest, you know, very left coast place. She's living there. She's a former foster child. She's had a really rough upbringing, but she's made it through the system and she's on her own, just a few days into her first apartment on her own, and she's raped. And after she's raped, she calls her foster mother, she calls her boyfriend, she calls 911, and her statement is taken, and everything a rape kit is administered, and everything is kind of going along like it does in this kind of a crime. And then somebody calls the police and casts just a seed of doubt on her story. Just a, she might be not telling the truth about this. And that suddenly twists the lens, and law enforcement then only sees her as not a victim anymore, but as actually somebody who's doing a false report, hence the title false report. And instead of trying to help her, they start interrogating her. And as a result of that, she recants the rape and she says, I guess I must have dreamed it. And she basically has to walk back her entire story to her great shame. And, you know, so, you know, not only do they stop trying to find her rapist, but they actually charge her with a false report. So skipping ahead, meanwhile, just a few months later, in another part of the U.S., in Denver, in the suburbs of Denver, Colorado, where I lived for several years, this rapist who did rape Marie goes to Denver suburbs and starts raping a whole bunch more women. And finally, you know, justice is served, but at what cost? So that's it in a nutshell, that journey. I asked people like what three words this book kind of left them with. So I'm going to say tenacity, spiderweb, I hope that's one word, and gratitude. I could also have said what the fuck as my three words, but anyway, I took the high road. So what are your three words, guys?
Okay, well, let's start with Paloma, who's had her hand up for a little while. So,
okay, three words. Both, I guess, both shocking and non-shocking. I don't know if that's one word or one word hyphenated. And then also, tenacity would also be a word I would use, I guess.
Yeah, so I mean, tenacity, I mean, the number of people who just had to stick with this case and just, you know, in the minutiae of this case is how it was solved, which is so amazing to me. And we're going to talk about how if this one little thing hadn't happened, they couldn't have unlocked it. But yeah, the tenacity of law enforcement. And as much as law enforcement in Marie's case in Linwood got it wrong, there's a bunch other law enforcement that got it right and would not give up. They were tenacious about their job. Yeah. And what was your other word again?
Shocking and then unshocking. So not surprising, I guess. From my knowledge and experience I've had, it's not, I mean, that happens. People aren't believed. And right. No doubt's been placed. And I had a really close family friend whom that kind of happened to. She was raped by the football player in her high school. And nobody believed her. And she was actually kicked out of her own high school and had to go to a community college. And it was kind of horrible.
God, I'm so sorry. Yeah, I mean, and this one good thing about this book is it goes into kind of where that comes from, the history of not believing the victim. It's just unbelievable in our history, you know, how that opinion was formed. But okay, who else has words?
Okay, so we have Anna.
I would say collaboration, I think, between the Colorado cops, who mm-hmm. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the two main detectives were women on that.
They were, yes, indeed.
So I wonder, you know, if that played into them wanting to solve this.
So, you know, and obviously, as Jolene knows, there were tons of other people involved that unlocked the key to this story. A lot of unsung heroes, unsung analysts, and the book really tries to tell you about them. Yes, certainly those two detectives, Stacey Galbraith and Edna Hendershot, were, you know, definitely the shining stars. And that's why they're making a series about this, which is how I even heard about the case to begin with, I was having a breakfast with a producer and she was telling me about the project she was working on. And she told me the story and I was like, wow, this sounds like a case that we should cover. And lo and behold, I found the book. So when that series does come up to fruition, boy, would I love to cast that. Let me tell you, I already have some ideas. But anyway, I'll definitely let you guys know when it's airing and where.
And I would also say vindication as a word, just because in the end she was believed and she got restorations. Maria got restorations.
Right.
From the city. And then I guess I don't have a third word, but I think telling maybe might be a good word.
So what was that?
Telling, like it's just telling of the situation of what a lot of women go through so that the next time this happens, people who read this book can say, hey, you know, women don't just lie a lot of the times. There's truth.
Right. Think about vindication though. Like once you have that dark cloud over you, I don't think you can ever really get from under it. You know, I mean, even if, you know, on the books she's been vindicated, she's still, I think her case is still listed as an unwarranted accusation in on somebody's, some Fakakta guy's blog somewhere, you know? So I think once that pool is stained, you just cannot totally get that off of you.
I suppose the question isn't so much why was he so hard to find as how were they actually able to find him at all?
Well, he's now been convicted of crimes that stretch back to 2008, but these two detectives and the FBI special agent who worked on it are convinced that his deeds may go back decades.
I want to ask you about the title, the book title. Now, let me tell you, All Be Gone in the Dark is a killer, no pun intended, title. I mean, that is like an amazing title for a book. It's just so intriguing. But what did you think of the title of this book?
I don't know. At first blush, I think the title itself was a little bit misleading at first, like the, you know, the false report aspect of it. And then, I mean, the outcome obviously was totally amazing. But when I first picked it up, that's not the story that I thought that I was going to be reading from. If you hadn't read the inside cover, I guess I should say.
Yeah. I mean, that's what occurred to me, that it sent, because I didn't know what a false report was, so we come to know what it is. It sounded kind of clinical and kind of like, you know, it didn't kind of grab you. And I'm sad about that because it is a book that does grab you from the first page, yeah, for me anyway. And I think the title might sort of, you know, not put people off, but like they don't really know when they crack the cover that it's going to be such a ride. Did anybody else feel that way?
Let's hear from Wendy.
Hey, Wendy.
I had the same thoughts Jolene had with the book. And I always wondered how many people walked by that book in the bookstore and saw the title and thought it was all about how there's a prevalence of false reports of rape.
Right.
You know, and so the title really did bother me a lot.
Yeah.
Giving the wrong impression as to what the book was really about.
Well, I think also if those words, a false report, don't ping with you as like an official charge, it sounds kind of vanilla. Like it doesn't sound as important as it really is. So, I mean, we certainly learned that it is a very important phrase. But yeah, you know, this will change when it turns into a TV series. I guarantee you it's not going to be called that. You know, it's going to have a different title. So Jenny?
Yep.
Who's next? Okay, great.
Jenny and Sophie, so good.
I remember you from last time. Hey, good to see you.
Hi. I agree that the title was kind of dry and very clinical sounding, it didn't really say exactly what it was going to be about, but I kind of had a different take on what I thought it was going to be about, and that was, I thought it was going to be comparing a false report, like a true false report, against, you know, non-false reports, because I thought, oh, that'll be interesting, because I wanted to get some ammunition about, you know, because it's always, oh, you know, he said, she said. So I thought that this was going to give me some insights on how to, you know, think about that and be able to kind of talk out, I don't know, against that. But that's not what it was. But it was really good anyway. I mean, I was thinking, why are we spending so much time with Marie? Because, I mean, you know, they're telling us that she didn't tell the truth. And what? And then I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. So, I mean, I thought that was really good. And the way that it eventually came to the reveal was phenomenal.
Yes, I want to talk about the structure very soon because it's just an incredible structure. I went back and I reread the book a second time now, just kind of tracking how they, you know, built the story. But we'll talk about that in a second. Sophie, did you want to weigh in here? She's got her hand raised.
I just think that the original title that they had in ProPublica was mm-hmm. An Unbelievable Story of Rape seemed much more compelling because yes. It kind of grabs your attention and wants you to get in. And my parents actually have lived in Golden for the last, I don't know, 15 years now. So this happened while they were there. And that just makes mm-hmm. it so close to home and terrifying to think about this guy running around Colorado doing these types of things.
Had they heard about this case?
No, I don't think any of us had heard of this. And I mean, I was in Fort Collins until 2009, but I was in and out, you know, visiting my parents all the time, and I never heard this story. So it's even more surprising.
Yeah. So for those of you who haven't read the book, this guy stalked his victims for hours and hundreds of hours before and did practice runs, you know, breaking in and out of their apartments. I just can't imagine. That is so shocking to me that nobody saw them. And even after he had assaulted these women and he would take the bedding, I mean, who doesn't see a guy dressed all in black, you know, with all these sheets going back to, it's just, you'd think that he would have dropped more breadcrumbs, but he didn't. I mean, he got away with this for, you know, at least until 2011. So from 2008 to 2011 that we know of, that's when he was active. But I mean, didn't that shock you on how he really just planned it out? This, it does remind me of, Golden State Killer, East Area Rapist in a way. I mean, I was pinging that constantly. Was anybody else pinging that?
Yeah, we're getting lots of chat messages saying it was just eerily similar to GSK, just the, you know, the way he would case the place and the tying up, and obviously not as violent. But I think it's lucky that they caught him, because doesn't he look a lot like the East Area Rapist before he graduated to the Golden State Killer?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. If he kept going, if he would eventually have to cross that line, that's something I would love to ask Laura and Jim, if that typically happens. I don't know, Jolene, do you have an insight into that at all in law enforcement, that, you know, if rapists at this level, at the serial level, do they kind of need more and more stimulation to get off?
At the level that this guy was at before he was captured, his escalation point had went for so long that I can only imagine that he would have escalated up to that other echelon of, you know, insanity. But who's to say that he didn't, and we just don't know because nobody's broke open the wretch. So
right. Right.
You know, the one thing, I don't think anybody have they? I looked around to see if anybody, is, to my knowledge, it's still in evidence and has never been actually successfully cracked.
Yeah. 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 I don't know. I mean, unless there's something more in those secret files that he have that reveal more, but it does seem like, you know, unlike that piece of shit Golden State Killer, I mean, he did seem to have some sort of remorse for what he was doing, a self-awareness of what he was doing when he would leave his victim and apologize or say, you know, so ironically, make sure you lock your back door. I mean, that just boggles my mind, you know?
Yeah, it's very hard to digest that whole process that his brain went through from, in those sets of hours that he was there, however long he was there each time, to going from that to then, hey, lock your door next time. Or, you know, you don't see that very often in any of these cases. I mean, you can go back through history and look at different serial killers, and you don't see that many that are, that have those two dualities in their personality when it comes to their crime.
Right.
I thought it was interesting too, Lisa, that the fact that they had familial DNA, they knew that there was a familial link, but in 2011, it was, you know, long before GEDmatch, and so there wasn't a database. It wasn't in CODIS. They weren't going to find him through old-fashioned police work. So I thought that was like, just if that had happened just a bit later, they would have caught him soon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He was going out late at night. He was out trolling around looking for rape.
Did you have any idea that somebody was stalking you?
Not at all.
Watching your every movement?
No.
Walking in and out of your house?
No idea whatsoever.
So let's talk about the POVs in this book. Again, the structure of this book is so interesting. Now, I had a big criticism of Michelle McNamara's book, and admittedly, it was published posthumously, so, you know, I give her all of the credit in the world that she would have crafted it a little better, but in this book, you really see how you can have simultaneous stories going on, and, you know, starting in one point of time, and then being able to backtrack, but connect it to, like, everything was so tight, you know, everything informed each other. Even we were going back and forth from Seattle suburbs to Denver suburbs, and going through quite a lot of characters. I mean, not just the detectives, but the analysts and the prosecutors. It all, like a spider web, connected. And you could keep following Marie's journey and keep following Detective Galbraith's journey and Detective Hendershot's journey, you know, and all of these rivers that met. And I think that is just such a hard thing to do, because they certainly could have told this just chronologically, you know, just by the numbers. But instead, they really crafted it in a certain way that you went on this journey with all of these people, mostly women. And I just think that's just an extraordinary stroke of editing. It's just an extraordinary way to deliver the story. And, you know, sometimes you see that in the best true crime series, where the writing is that tight. And I just love that that was true here. I don't know if anybody else agrees with that or noticed the structure at all.
Yeah, I think it was, it really set up that punch when Galbraith finds the camera that he stole from the previous victim, and she's scrolling through going, oh yeah, that. Wait a minute, who is this? It's like, wow, that's goosebumps. Mm-hmm. You know, and you could connect to that because you already knew about Marie, even though, mm-hmm. you know, they hadn't found her yet. So it was really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody else chiming in on that? Let me just.
Yeah, Jenny's going to come back in.
I listened to a podcast by the authors on Longshot, but they were talking about the article that they had written. Mm-hmm. And I think part of why they were able to do that so nicely is because they had both been working on it separately. I think it said that in the back of the book, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And luckily for them, one had been working in Washington and one had been working in Colorado. So they were already both telling these separate stories. And when they came together, I think that's how it ended up having that kind of power that way. And the way they described it is like the story in Washington was more like meditative and introspective. And the story as they told it in Colorado was more like a chase film or a, you know, true crime kind of what's going to happen next kind of thing.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I think balancing that voice is really hard. Yeah. Go ahead, Paloma.
I thought the point of view was very powerful because you really got into the mindset of the different people, and it made it a lot more creepier when you went into the mindset of the rapist. Mm-hmm. And then you could also kind of get the point of view and the way they kind of thought, which I thought was very powerful. But yeah, everybody thought, the detectives. And
Was anybody pissed off that they included the offender's point of view? So for those of you who don't know, we go through, you know, each detective's journey and each, you know, kind of each victim's journey. And then all of a sudden we switch into the offender's journey, him at some point telling these writers how this all started for him from seeing, it's going to piss my husband off, seeing Princess Leia in the Jabba the Hutt slave costume was like the first time that he felt this urge to control women. And, you know, he goes through his entire mental journey. Did anybody hate that?
Okay, we got quite a few people want to chime in here. So okay, we're going to bring...
I'm going to stop talking. You guys talk.
Okay, in the Wendy's back, and we've got Tony, Sophie, and Amy.
Yeah, that kind of, I would love to know the author's reason for doing that. Was it to teach us something about him, or to teach us how to look out for some sort of predator? Because other than that, there's no reason to put his point of view in there at all. This was about the people he hurt and the victims. They're the ones who should have been center stage, not him.
Can I offer a counterpoint to that? Sure. In that I'm sure that the victims wondered, why me? How did this happen? And he offers it up on a plate, play sure. by play, how he did it. And it certainly opened my eyes to, there's a chapter called Fishbowl, where he can just see everybody going about their daily lives like they're in a fishbowl. And he had all of this easy access to people. So in that way, I thought that that was very powerful. And I didn't feel like the authors were trying to be apologetic about his crime or his background. So for me, that was important. But I completely understand if people just did not want to hear a word from him.
I felt scared. I felt scared for other women in society. I felt afraid for myself. That's why I think we were so driven.
It's a question that you ask again and again. Is it somebody that has been involved in more horrific things in the past?
You know what? Can we skip down to Amy and Tracy? Because I don't think we've heard from them yet.
Yeah, I think that... hi. Sorry I'm late. There's 5 kids in my house. It was crazy. I think that having the point of view of the offender, when you read a lot of sometimes these true crimes, you don't have, like, you're like, why? Why would he do that? How did he do this? Why would he do this? Why? And so then you hear it just in as plain talk as you're talking about your grocery list, because that's what it is for them. It's a methodical, like, this is my daily life. This is how I do this. And so it gives a good counterpoint to the fear and the frustration and the anger you get, because you are sympathetic to the victims. You are sympathetic because either you've been there or you know somebody that has, or, you know, there's always questions to the violence, but you don't necessarily hear how those people just get up and eat breakfast and stalk people and go to bed. So yeah, so it was surprising. I did listen to it on Audible because I knew I'd get angry and I didn't want to throw the book constantly. But it was interesting when they started giving his storyline. It was like, oh, that's who this is. And it was interesting because then you're talking it out and you're hearing it and you're like, this is weird. Like, this is your neighbor. This is someone. Yeah. This is how someone can think, because you know, those of us that don't, we just cannot fathom that whole thing. So yeah, this
Jim talks about this as the nice guy predator or the nice guy offender.
Yes.
And, you know, this is a guy who had a brother who he lived with, kind of knew he was on the edges of an extreme philosophy or whatever, but. You know, we all know people like that who are just all, you know, all talk and whatever, but you don't imagine what they could be capable of. So it does open your eyes, you know, and he was married and the military and this and that. One thing I don't want to forget, because Jim will kill me if I don't. So the offender did talk about some of the things that he studied in order to become good at his crime, and one of them is called Rape Investigation Handbook by John Savino, who is a New York City, former New York City cop, and by Brent Turvey. If you know Jim, you know how he feels about Brent Turvey, who I don't know Mr. Turvey, but he's a self-described criminal profiler, and I would say that Jim would take issue he is a profiler. So it's interesting that this rapist got his, you know, manual on how to do this from a rape investigation handbook. And I mean, you know, everybody, you know, I hear this all the time, like, what should you do? Should we not publish anything about
you know, should you never publish something like that? Because it helps people understand how to avoid law enforcement. You know, this taught this rapist that he could have the victim, and how humiliating, have her wash herself and take a shower and clean herself and take all of her bedding, because he knew that would make it much, much harder to get his DNA. And he learned that somewhere. So I don't know, where is the line between, you know, telling the public what's, you know, what to do and yet not educating offenders? Jolene, since we have you, have you ever taken calls from people, women or men, who have just been raped, you know, on your 911 call?
Oh yeah. I've taken a lot of, I couldn't even tell you how many, honestly, but I guess more that has stuck with me is when moms or dads have called in when they found out their children have been molested or raped. Those are the calls that are more prevalent than, and I guess it's because most of the women that have called in that have been raped or sexually assaulted have waited days. So right then, you know, it's like, not in Marie's case where she called, you know, after she made two phone calls, it was right then. Where the ones that I've taken, it's been days later where they've probably talked to somebody and then somebody said, hey, you need to, you know, call. So that's the only call I've never taken is like the immediate, like, rape that just happened. Not to the point where they've been hysterical. I mean, date rapes, yes, but not anything like in Marie's situation, obviously, because that's a really, really crazy story from the jump. But I would say it's probably frightening that people that there's a lot more children and molestations and rapes of children that are now reported than say 20 years ago than when I first started this. I mean, it's a daily thing now where it never used to be that way before.
But what I will say is in a crazy way, it's probably a good thing because those molestations were always happening. But now they're not being hidden in the dark, and away parents are getting in there and being involved. I mean, I think that's just
I think that's a step in the evolution from the whole process too, from women when they're older, actually, you know, now when it's started younger, like now that they're reporting things when children are younger, then you won't have these cases when people are older. Maybe the cases will, you won't have these people waiting so long because we'll stop the stereotype like was in this case of not being believed. And the continued skepticism of women that are reporting it, maybe that's a tide that'll turn.
Well, let's talk about this. So, you know, Marie wasn't believed, and what we find out is the history of assault on women in general, that they have to pass this incredible bar to be believed. And if you if you wait 4 days to report this, that is like a very negative check mark to the officer who's like, why did you wait so long? Blah, 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 blah. Right. You know, it's just incredible. And to see the history of how that's been true and how, I forget who they were talking about, but from hundreds of years ago, just having a bar, you know, did she resist enough? And did she say no? How many times did she say no? I think I've learned from Jim and Laura that there's no one way that anybody acts in a trauma. You know, this is what I talk about. Like even when we talked about the Meredith Kircher murder and how Amanda Knox behaved, or, you know, any number of people that we've talked about, how they behave and the person next to them is like looking at their behavior and judging it. And they're not an expert in behavior. But yeah, what they say matters to law enforcement.
There is absolutely no guide to how someone reacts. And I can say that from being the person that gets the call right then. You know, I've had people call in and say, like, they're like one of the other participants said, you know, they talk about it like it's their grocery list when they found out that their child's been molested. And then I've had other people call in and you can't even talk to them. And it's been months since it's happened, but they're so hysterical. So, I mean, there is no guideline for how people react to any one particular situation. You can't do that. And when you get tunnel vision like that, that just makes the rest of us look terrible. You know, you can't have one set of ideals about how somebody reacts to some type of trauma. You can't. Everybody reacts different.
And that's something that, anybody else want to say something about that? Amy, do you want to weigh in on that? She's got her hand up.
Oh, yeah. Sophie's been waiting as well. Oh. So I'll just...
Sophie, please. Sorry, Sophie.
The way Marie reacts, it doesn't seem that odd to me, considering how she'd already been abused multiple times and been moved from family to family. Like, for her, even she wasn't necessarily hysterical because she'd already learned how to compartmentalize these things and dealt with them, and had already probably been not believed before, or at least had her feelings pushed aside before. So for her to kind of come in and be more blank isn't surprising with her history. And I don't think it's surprising for any woman who's been, you know, we've all been, you know, the Me Too movement, we've all been sexually harassed most of our lives. We're used to it. We know when something's really bad, it's not necessarily going to be as easy to drum up all those emotions from every single thing you've ever dealt with.
No. Well, there's a quote about that Marie was confronted with a world gone mad, like a world that doesn't believe her. And, you know, she's got to, you know, justify her every single movement. And, you know, and that, and I know that that is true for so many people where they're assaulted by somebody, yet they still have to be in proximity to that person. Everybody's acting normal, like nothing happened. And yet, yeah, I mean, I understand that sort of fugue state that you could get into when you have to, you know, function in a world that is completely topsy turvy.
Lisa, I thought when they got her back in, I'd be interested to hear what people think, but the key points where Peggy even said it herself after it was all over, had I not have called in and expressed doubts to, what was his name, Mason, to Detective Mason, this thing probably would never have happened. And he took the ball and ran with it.
And as we
just heard, I mean, she was sexually molested at 7 and she was on Zoloft by the age of 8. How was she supposed to react? Who was it saying just before there that, you know, she spent her whole life coping, and how do you get through a normal life? You know, you've got to just deal with it internally. So that's not surprising. And then unfortunately he wasn't trained at all, obviously in dealing with sexual assault cases. Had she have gotten Hendershot or somebody like that, this also would never have happened. She wouldn't have gotten railroaded, but anyway, sad.
That's a good point, that they didn't have a sexual crimes unit, you know, they didn't have Law and Order SVU or whatever. And this person that Marie dealt with had been in narcotics or something totally different. And he really got on the wrong track. You know, there was another detective too, who was right there with him, interrogating her, scaring her, trying to basically say, you're going to go to jail if you don't tell us this. You know, for an 18-year-old girl, my goodness, it must have been just overwhelming for her. The interesting thing is that, Officer Mason, or I don't know how, he's a detective or whatever, you know, he actually came back and tried to make amends, at least, you know, met her face to face and apologized. And this other detective just vanished, would not apologize to her, just threw it under the rug. And I know that the Linwood police did do an internal and external investigation into their procedures, and hopefully they learned something. But Jesus, you know, surely she's probably not the only one that this happened to.
Yeah, that's what I was when I think her name was Peg, when she called in and said those things. Like, how dare you take someone and run them through the ringer? Like, say those things. Like, oh, I think she's lying. She's lying. And it's like, wait, like, I'm a stoic person. When bad things happen, I get quiet, I get calm, I want to listen, I want to get answers, I want people to hear, like, we need to all figure out what's going on. And if something like that were to happen, I wouldn't be in hysterics. I wouldn't be going nuts. I'm that person. And like when they use the interrogation techniques that they use with bank robbers and career criminals to try and get her to elicit the answers that they wanted. Oh, I was just so mad. I had to pause it. I was just so mad. And it's just, it's victim shaming. It's just victim shaming in a completely different way. And it's just so...
Well, I know one of the detectives said that it's not that she always believes the victim, but she always listens to the victim and verifies. And I think that that's such an important distinction. Verify, verify, verify. And not change the lens so quickly into seeing them as, you know, a possible false report or, I don't know what they were saying, like, you know, a date that went too far and the woman's regretful. I mean, all of that bullshit, you know.
Yeah, and you guys have talked on the podcast before about how, like, you know, when the details are there and, you know, when the story is fluid and, you know, the information is there, that is something to be said for. You know, they aren't moving in tense. You know, she wasn't shifting herself in and out of present, past, and future tenses and things like that. Like, there was a fluidity to her statement that she had to give 5 times with no sleeping. Like, there was just all of these things that it just kept going, and it just kept, I knew where they were headed. I knew that they were going to discredit or somehow push her into, you know, saying, backing out of what she had to say because she wasn't some sort of random textbook that somebody read one time. Oh, it's just so frustrating.
Yeah, I was taking notes when I was reading it that, FYI, if you're ever raped, and I realize the audience I'm talking to, most likely many of you have been assaulted. Just FYI, in the future, if you are raped, you know, make sure you memorize every detail and, you know, fight to survive, or make sure that you have enough defense marks on your body to prove that you struggled, or make sure you say that you don't want this to be happening, or try to talk the abuser out of it. Try to be like, be on their side and go with it, and make sure you memorize everything about the attacker's face, even though you don't really want to be fucking looking at this guy's face when this is happening. Right. And make sure you memorize everything on his body as he's assaulting you. Even though you just want to keep your eyes shut, call 911 right away, cry and act upset, and make sure you say the same story again and again and again. Even if you remember something different and you don't correct your story, and just keep acting upset to anybody you see. Just keep acting upset. Otherwise, forget it. You're not reading the script. You're not playing the role. And that is just, and always wear a hazmat suit and not like a skirt. Right. Yeah. Definitely don't wear shorts or a tank top, please, or lipstick. It's absurd.
And for someone to be a former child that was molested, like, you regress back. There are cases where they just freeze back. They're 6 again. And so, you know, that was her survival. That's her fight like hell. I was all fired up.
Yeah, the book really, it took you there. Dean, where are we, Dean?
We had Tony, yeah. So we've got you on audio.
Just, I'm going to backtrack a little tiny bit. This whole situation, like I said, I'm a police dispatcher. I come from that background. And all I kept thinking, especially when they got to the point where they're interrogating Marie, and the second it mentioned the Reed technique, I was just going, oh my God, no, 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 no. The Reed technique, at least in my department, given I work for a very tiny department, and we train and train and train over everything.
So, Tony, tell them what the Reed thing is.
So, the Reed technique of interrogation, the best way I can describe it based on my experience is we're all familiar with the stereotype of the good cop, bad cop technique. Mm-hmm. The Reed technique is only the bad cop side of it. It's you drill and you drill and you drill and you don't give the person a chance to talk. And you just say, you did this, didn't you? You robbed that bank. You're the one who planned all this. You did the da-da-da-da-da-da. That stereotypical bad cop is the Reed technique. Yeah. And it, for generations of cops, has been the way to do it. In our department, anyone caught doing the Reed technique, for lack of a better term, your ass is grass. Like, it does not fly. The brass doesn't like it. The chief doesn't like it. You do not do the Reed technique. Because it's so aggressive, it's actually been proven to elicit false confessions. And to me, what I feel like with Marie recanting her story twice, to me, that's equivalent to a false confession. She thought that was the only way to get home, or that was the only way to save her to save having a home, or it was just so coercive and controlling, and it just made me sick to realize that they were still using the read technique. And she was, one thing I kept thinking, once again, through the lens of my department, was going, don't any of these officers have CIT training, which is crisis intervention training? Don't any of these officers have trauma-based interrogation techniques? Because sometimes you have to ask a victim these horrible questions, and to a degree, you do have to re-victimize them because you have to know what happened.
Yeah.
But there's a way to do it, and it's very difficult for both. Because as a cop, or like in my department, our dispatchers double as backup investigators. I run criminal histories and do all kinds of stuff to help our officers. It's like, on the one hand, you want to catch the bad guy. Someone broke the law and you want to catch him. But at the same time, you don't want to re-traumatize your victim. I mean, we talk about trauma by proxy and re-victimizing. Mm-hmm. And just the whole time I'm reading this book, I genuinely had to remind myself this was 10 years ago. Maybe they just didn't know. Because I was just getting so frustrated. At one point, so I'm going to give myself away. I work for a teeny tiny department, so we have some downtime. I was reading the book at work, and at one point I legit threw the book across the dispatch center just as one of my sergeants was walking in. So I almost hit him with a book.
Oh my
God. He's, what is wrong? He picks up my book, looks at it, and he goes, this sounds interesting. And we were discussing it, and even he was just appalled just at the tiny little Cliff Notes version I gave him. He's like, right. What kind of cops are these? And I had to remind him. It was 10 years ago. They probably didn't know any better.
Let me tell you something. The next thing I want to talk about, you know, really quick is the prosecutor, Bob Weiner. When they finally catch the offender, and how great is it that Detective Galbraith was like there, and she had that moment of, I've got him, you know, after all her work and following all these leads and, you know, to finally see him face to face and say, I've got you, motherfucker, you're going to jail. But anyway, so, you know, the prosecutor, Bob Weiner, he's got a whole other thing to worry about the jury, and not, you know, something he called downstreaming, which is the tendency of each person in the chain to think about how the rape accusation will look to the next person. So they have to worry about how the jury, I mean, like we were just saying, a juror saying, well, why didn't she fight? Or why did she call her boyfriend first? Or like to question the victim's action and not even really hear the physical evidence. I mean, that just struck me, you know, just really hard that you have to be worried about that in a jury.
And it wasn't until Stacey Galbraith came home after her first victim interview and was talking to her husband, who also happens to be a cop, and they were sharing what happened during their day, and he said, wait a minute, I think we had a case just like that, like 6 months ago, because there's some specific things that this guy was doing that stuck out. And he said, you should talk to our detective and our precinct. And it wasn't until these two women got together, and then they formed a task force in the greater Denver area. That's how they were able to track him down.
We have to wrap it up, but what else do you guys want to talk about before we do so? Anything else about the book that you wanted to point out? I love the you know, the computer guy who just would not give up on trying to open up that wretch file. Yeah. I mean, and then the whole reason that Marie was even vindicated, somebody talked about that, is because how random. The perpetrator took a picture of her while he was assaulting her with her ID on her chest. I mean, why would he do that? I don't even know. And that picture, somebody all the way the fuck over in Denver saw it and said, okay, this here is another one of his victims. Let's find her. I mean, that is so random. All of that. But thank goodness that everybody just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. Otherwise, Marie would never have.
I've got a question. Was Marie his first victim or no?
This book doesn't say.
Like, as far as the book's contents are concerned, is she the first? And if so, let's say she is the first victim. If she was the first victim and she was the first one that he ever did that to, so had he not done that to her, then he may never have been caught, or at least not for quite some time. If he never laid anybody else's ID on their chest and took his trophy. Yeah. How crazy, bizarre. Anyway,
so random. But. Yeah, I don't know if she was the first. I mean, he definitely, when they turn to his point of view, he talks about his lead up to breaking in and then losing his nerve. And then, you know,
yeah.
I don't know if anybody remembers, but I don't know if they said that, that Marie was his first. You got to think he wasn't.
Meg's come in, and Meg has a background in forensics, so maybe she would like to hear from her. Go ahead, Meg.
The fact that the detectives completely ignored evidence that was right in front of their faces. There were ligature marks on her wrists. There were
pieces
of evidence that were in her. It was so horrible to see that.
And they destroyed her rape kit.
Yes. It was heartbreaking, and it made me so angry.
Are there any other questions I put out there that we have not covered? It sounds like we kind of
covered a fair bit of ground.
And you said, do you have a burning comment?
Bringing her in now.
I met you at CrimeCon, and I just wanted to say, loved it. Thank you for opening this book club so that we could all be together and interact and just really weigh in with Jolene and Dean and Lisa and everybody. I am a loyal follower of the podcast, and I can't wait for the next one.
Oh, so my God.
And I'm wearing my CrimeCon t-shirt.
Woohoo!
Everybody needs to go. Thank you for including us. And when's our next book club?
Oh, God. Okay. I don't know. We will talk. Anna, also, thank you so much for that. You don't even know what that does for me right now. It really means a lot. Anyway, Anna has her hand up as well.
I was going to ask the same question. I only found out about this book club a few hours ago. I had already read the book. So how do we know when the next book is or when the next book club is? What are you using, Facebook?
Yeah, I mean, Facebook, is that an old-fashioned thing to use now? I don't know. But so for me, you know, Facebook and Twitter are, you know, the best ways, and we'll try to keep it up on our website. But Anna, do you listen to the podcast?
Yes. Yeah, I do. And I also wanted to say, too, I noticed that, Dean, I think you're the only man on here. So I just wanted to say that, you know, us ladies gotta figure out how to get more dudes paying attention too, you know.
That's a really interesting observation, and I'm on the Facebook page for the for Case File as well, the Aussie true crime thing, and there's me and another guy, Darren. But this whole true crime, it's a topic for another discussion. But it's like 90-something% female fans of true crime, which, considering most of the crimes, like the one we're discussing here, are horrific male on female crimes almost exclusively. It's a interesting dynamic, and it'd be an interesting discussion, but not for today. But thanks for noticing, Anna.
And what a man. You make up for every man out there. So did you want to say something else?
I just saw also, it looks like somebody asked where we could make book suggestions for the future. Where's the best way you think we could do that?
Definitely on Facebook. I mean, it's kind of like our podcast. Like, we'll think that we're going to cover a case, and then something will happen. I'm like, no, let's cover this. So it's kind of a seat of the pants kind of thing. And I don't know if we should continue to cover nonfiction, or if we should do fiction. I don't know. I so seldom read fiction anymore because I have to read my scripts and stuff that I kind of would rather read something real. But please just post on Facebook, and, you know, we'll figure it out. We do have a couple of sponsors coming up for books. So maybe that, you know, if I like the book, then maybe that could be something. So I don't know. Who knows? But God, it is so nice to talk to you guys. It is like amazing for me. It's such a gift to be able to interact with you like this. Any other last minute questions before I kind of do my sign off?
We like your hair. How did you dye it?
Well, I used Madison Reed hair dye. Actually, it was super easy. And they know me well because they had like two pairs of plastic gloves, because I definitely am a mess when I dye my hair. But anyway, it was super easy, and I think it looks pretty good.
You know, I tried to buy some Madison Reed product, but they refused to sell it to me. They didn't think I'd be an appropriate brand ambassador. So, which just only goes to show how classy they are. So they make you look fabulous, Lisa. But
Dean. You know, I got to thank Dean. I could not do this without him. Do you think I could figure this out? Are you crazy? And the fact that he takes the time out of his day, and he's in Australia. And we have to figure out a time. The poor guy, last time you guys had to get up at like 5 a.m. or something to do this.
Yeah, it was a bit horrible. So I'm glad I was able to negotiate a slightly more – it's a Sunday morning here, of course. So it was only a 7 a.m. get up to get ready. So that's okay. But I think we really have to – we've sort of set the time zones to be for us and the U.S. and our – poor old Euro listeners have copped it pretty hard. So we need to look after. Give them some love next time.
Yes. You know, that's why – so this will be posted on YouTube for others to enjoy. I just want to say that, you know, when Jim and Laura and I, you know, we created this podcast like 2 years ago, which is really old in podcast age, I guess. You know, we didn't have any idea what would happen. We just started recording. We didn't have any sponsors. We didn't have any of that. We just started recording and just kind of threw it out there. And we are so blessed that people liked it, want to listen to it, have been fans from the beginning, and yet we still continue to get new fans. You know, I really want to acknowledge that I get emails every day from people who are suffering, who have been abused, domestic abuse, child sexual abuse. They all want to tell their stories. And I'm so, so grateful that you do that, that you feel that that's a conduit for you to reach out to. And when we can help, we try to hook you up with what resources you need. Obviously, we can't dispense advice, but we really try to at least listen to your story. And that is such a generous gift that you give us. I really, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot right now, how grateful I am. And all things end. Oh, I'm sure someday this may end. But I really feel like next to having my children, that this was really like the most important thing that I've done with my life is to do this. Doing this has really just been a huge blessing. So I wanted to thank you for that and keep listening. We're going to, you know, do our thing. Always just, you know, keep reaching out, hopefully keep passing along our little podcast to people. And thank you, Jolene, Dean, everybody. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
Mille grazie. And we'll see you next time.
Yep.
On Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.